20. The raw ore was in the crucible. The furnace was built, filled with charcoal and sealed. Inchgower lit the coals and instructed the wizards to place the business ends of their bellows onto the holes at the base of the furnace, one on each side so as not to crowd each other. The wizards did as he said, but knowing what was going to come next, Tyler made sure everyone had used the restroom before they plugged the last bellows into its hole. As predicted, the instant the bellows were in place, Inchgower said,
"All right, lads, now the easy part. All you have to do is pump your bellows, one at a time, so that there's a steady flow of air into the fire for the next 6 hours."
Tyler said, "I fear that does mean 6 hours straight with no break." Inchgower said,
"Yes, the whole 6 hours, non-stop."
Tyler said, he was expecting the question. Inchgower said,
"I'm afraid so. Any more questions?"
Tyler said, "We didn't have any questions." Inchgower said,
"Good, then it's time to start pumping. Off you go."
As they each took their stations, Tyler muttered, "If I get my hands on Todd, I'll kill him. If just for subjecting us to this crappy workmanship."
"On the bright side," Philip said, "your arms will be in good shape for it."
The actual business of pumping the bellows worked out to be very much like a large, polite, slow game of Hungry Hungry Hippos, wherein each player simply took their turn eating a marble. Each man pumped his bellows in turn, and the action traveled around the furnace at a steady pace. The first hour passed in grim silence, each man trying hard not to say or even think about how much they were not enjoying pumping the bellows. During the second hour, they tried to play I Spy, but it did not go well. They got off to a bad start when Gary said he spied something that started with a B and eventually revealed that it was blacksmithing tools. When the others complained that since they were in a blacksmith shop, he had, in his first turn, used up virtually everything in the room, he merely said, "Then I guess I win." They tried playing a game Philip invented, which he called Desert Island Todd. The rules were simple. Imagine you were going to be exiled to a desert island with Todd, and list the three items you would bring along to beat and torture Todd with. Points were given for inventiveness, and for non-lethality, because they were better than Todd, and because killing Todd would just end his torment. Jimmy ended up winning, but at a terrible cost. His three picks were a towel, orange juice, and toothpaste. He had been further into the future than any of the others at that point, so he had to explain the concept of waterboarding. Once they understood that, he did not have to explain why he felt it would be even more unpleasant if you made Todd brush his teeth first, then used orange juice instead of water. They all agreed that this was the worst torture any of them had dreamed up yet, but instead of laughing and taking his next turn, Tyler went silent. Hearing Jimmy discussing inflicting hypothetical suffering on Todd had been a potent reminder of the time, not that long ago, when Jimmy had inflicted all too real suffering on Tyler. Tyler didn't say what was bothering him, but everybody knew, and nobody knew what to say. Finally, inevitably, it was Jimmy who broke the silence. He didn't know what to say either, but he knew that saying anything, even the wrong thing, would be better than saying nothing.
"Tyler," Jimmy said, "I've stopped saying I'm sorry every time I see you. But that doesn't mean I've stopped being sorry."
"Yeah," Tyler said. "That makes it all okay, doesn't it?"
"No, of course it doesn't. There's nothing I can say or do that will ever make any of it okay, but I'm not going to stop trying. Look, when we get out of this, I'll let you ghost me for just as long as I ghosted you."
"Great," Tyler said. "Fantastic. Except that we both know I'd never do that to you."
"And hopefully you know I would never do that to you again."
"Yeah, I know. It's the again that's the problem. There's a whole lot of stuff that I'd never do that you'd never do again. The thing that really burns me up is that I'd never get away without being punished, like you did."
Jimmy didn't want to argue with Tyler, but he had to. He couldn't let the idea that he hadn't been punished at all go unchallenged.
"Tyler, You can argue that the punishment didn't fit the crime, but you can't claim that there was no punishment.
Tyler said,
Spare me. We've all heard all about it. Wah, wah, I had to ride a bicycle. Big whoop.
For 30 years, Jimmy said. 30 years with no money, no friends, no family, in Central and South America in the 80s. I was in constant danger.
You poor baby. All you did was kill a town, and you had to endure the world's longest backpacking trip. That's really a fitting punishment.
You assume my punishment is over. It isn't. It won't be as long as I'm alive.
Tyler said, Oh, please.
Again, you can make the case that it's not enough punishment, but I've spent the last 3 years as a total pariah, and I don't see that ending anytime soon, or ever.
Is that supposed to make us feel guilty?
Tyler asked.
No, but I'd hoped you'd feel some empathy. I made this bed, and I will lie in it, but it'd be nice if occasionally someone mentioned that it's not a very nice bed, that's all.
Well, it's not gonna happen.
Yeah, Jimmy said. I've come to realize that. That's the pillow on the bed I've made.
Tyler chose not to respond to that. Jimmy chose not to add anything further. Philip and Gary chose to continue pretending that they weren't there. Tyler had said a few things that they had been thinking, and Jimmy had said a few things that they would need to think about. After some sullen, silent bellows pumping, Tyler said,
Jimmy, can I ask you a question?
Jimmy answered,
Anything.
This was Jimmy's reflexive answer to that question. In the past, he had often followed it by thinking,
You can ask me anything you want, so I'm not lying. It doesn't mean I'll answer you.
Tyler asked,
After everything you did you honestly expect us to forgive and forget?
Jimmy looked around the room and saw that while they were all working their bellows in perfect rhythm, the other three men were all staring at him, waiting to hear his answer. Jimmy said,
The short answer is no, of course not. I neither expected nor really hoped that any of you would forgive and forget. There's no forgiving what I did, and if you forgot it, you'd be fools.
Then why'd you bother to come back?
Tyler asked, sounding more irritated than curious.
Because of the third option. You can't forgive what I did, and none of us, especially me, should ever forget that I'm capable of what I did. But I needed to show you all, us all, that I won't ever do it again.
Tyler asked,
And how are you gonna do that?
Jimmy answered,
I thought not doing it would be enough. I was wrong. Now I wish I knew.
Philip chose this moment to participate.
You want us to trust you. It's not possible. There's no way to prove that you're not going to do something. Trust is a person believing that someone won't do any of the thousands of awful things that any of us can do to each other. You got everyone to trust you. Then you betrayed everyone's trust, repeatedly and in the worst possible ways. Even if you do want to be trustworthy again, how can we ever trust you?
So you're saying there's no way?
Jimmy, there's always a way. But sometimes the way to success is worse than just admitting failure. The only way to convince us that you won't betray us again is to live the rest of your life without betraying us again. If you can do that, those of us who outlive you will be forced to stand at your grave and say, He never betrayed us again. He changed. He was trustworthy after all.
Jimmy thought a moment, then said,
So you're telling me that the only way to convince you all that I'm not going to betray you is to spend the rest of forever not betraying you?
Pretty much,
Philip said.
Yeah, I'll get right on that,
Jimmy said sourly. They pumped their bellows in silence well into the evening, each of them lost in their own thoughts. At long last, Inchgower returned, carrying a large, rough, vaguely rectangular blob of hardened sand in his arms. It had the approximate proportions of a shoebox, only larger and more poorly made. He placed it on the floor.
Okay, lads,
the blacksmith shouted.
Pull out your bellows. You've pumped long enough.
Three of them removed their bellows. Inchgower got down on all fours and peered into one of the holes into which they had been blowing air. A bright orange light illuminated his face in the darkened shop as he squinted into the hole. He stood up, slapping his thighs to brush the dust off of the soot.
Good work, lads. Well done.
He turned his back, rummaging around his tool rack. When he turned back to face the furnace, he was holding a large sledgehammer. With one smooth swing, he struck the flat side of the furnace. A spiderweb of cracks radiated from the point of impact, revealing the glowing, fiery interior as the cool, dull exterior shattered and crumbled. It was beautiful, and like many beautiful things, it was also more than a little terrifying. The wizard saw the furnace crack open and spill coals across the floor like a fire piñata. They felt a wave of searing heat wash over their backs as they yelped and fled for the far corners of the room, where they would at least be burned slightly later than if they had stayed put. Only when they were in position, cringing and as far away as possible, did they dare to look back at the source of all that heat. The cracked walls and collapsed roof of the brick and clay furnace seemed to shimmer when viewed through the intense heat. Around the ruined base of the furnace, coals were heaped like gold coins around a sleeping dragon. Now exposed to ample oxygen, the coals were already beginning to turn a dull white instead of their original radiant orange, but the center of the pile still glowed. Inchgower put down his hammer. He made a show of looking weary and acting as if the heat was causing him discomfort. But he was standing less than 4 feet from the core. Several of the coals had rolled down the slope of the larger pile and came to rest right next to his boots. If he had been a real person, he'd either have fled with the wizards or he'd have been screaming. He shielded his eyes and said,
"Ooh, a bit toasty."
He placed his hammer back on the tool rack and lifted a large set of tongs built with an accordion-like set of joints so that they would lengthen as he closed them. He extended the tongs, then used them to knock the cooling crust off the top of the coal pile, exposing the glowing orange core and releasing fresh, rippling waves of heat. With a bit of work, he exposed the top of the sealed clay pot at the center of the fire, the crucible. He used the tongs to lift the crucible out of the fire. Gary gasped.
"That thing weighs a ton and he has no leverage. He must be strong as a bull."
"He's not real,"
Philip reminded him. Gary said,
"Yeah, well, that just makes it all the more impressive."
Philip said,
"Not really."
Inchgower placed the glowing orange crucible on the dirt floor. He produced a mallet and a chisel and knelt down. He placed the steel chisel along the seam of the crucible's lid and tapped it with a mallet, protecting himself from the intense heat via the time-honored method of squinting, panting, and saying,
"Hot, hot, 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 hot,"
as quickly as he could. The lid separated cleanly from the crucible and fell to the floor. Using the tongs, Inchgower lifted the radiant crucible over the rough sand mold he had placed on the floor. Carefully, he positioned the crucible over a hole in the top of the rectangular mass. He tipped the crucible, and for a moment it looked like he was pouring out a cup full of sun. A thin stream of pure light and heat streamed from the crucible into the hole. He tipped the crucible farther. The stream grew thicker. He lifted the crucible while maintaining the pour, like a bartender trying to make you think you're getting more than your allotted 2 ounces of vodka. The crucible ran dry. Inchgower discarded the tongs and empty crucible and sat on the dirt floor, listening to the mold as it cooled.
"We don't want to hear a pinging noise," he said.
"This is weird," Gary said.
"I thought we'd established that long ago,"
Philip replied.
"No, not the whole situation. This part in particular. I mean, up until now, Todd hasn't wasted a lot of time on the specifics. The mines were one big cave with the ore we needed right at the threshold. The castle was essentially a big fancy lobby for the secret passage. Everything's been really broad and simplistic, until this blacksmith shop. Now, suddenly he's wallowing in detail. Why?"
Philip said,
"Probably because this part calls for a lot of manual labor, and he's trying to make us miserable."
Tyler added, "And I suspect he might have dwelt on this a bit because he just thinks blacksmithing is cool." Inchgower leapt to his feet and declared,
"The Dylowine is cooling, lads. We've purified and toughened it, but we also need it to harden. Time for the quench. Remove the lid from the oil barrel.
Inchgauer pointed at a metal cylinder with a wooden lid, which stood just outside in front of the shop. Jimmy removed the lid, revealing the smooth black surface of the oil inside. Inchgauer grasped his sledgehammer and swung it over his head, bringing it down on the mold, which split open, then crumbled. The shape inside the mold, whatever it was glowing too brightly to look at for long. All they could tell was that it was something large and hot. Inchgauer again used the tongs, and with a noticeable but unrealistically small amount of effort, lifted the glowing mass into the air and lowered it into the oil. The air was filled with a deafening hiss, as if someone had stepped on God's pet snake. The surface of the oil burst into tall, orange, flickering tongues of flames, which disappeared when whatever it was Inchgauer was making disappeared beneath the surface. After a moment of tense silence, Inchgauer pulled the tongs back out of the oil. When the object breached the surface, it again burst into flames, but this time the flames persisted as Inchgauer held the burning mass high in the air like a torch, pushing back the night.
Yeah, Tyler said. Todd definitely thinks blacksmithing is cool.
Not period accurate, though, is it?
Philip asked.
They can't have had big barrels of crude oil just sitting around in this time period, could they?
Tyler said,
I think it's actually motor oil. And no, they didn't. If I remember correctly, back then they used either water or urine.
Huh, Jimmy said. It must have been a hard decision for Todd. Use oil, which is inaccurate but looks really cool, or have the blacksmith pee on it, which doesn't look nearly as cool, but would have forced us all to breathe pee steam.
Gary said,
I bet if he had used pee, he'd have named the blacksmith Calvin.
Inchgauer bellowed,
Behold, lads, the fruits of your labors.
He brought the huge ball of fire down closer to his face and demonstrated an unrealistic amount of lung capacity by blowing out the fire with one breath. He swung the tongs toward the wizards. The dull metal mass was no longer glowing, but it was still putting out an alarming amount of heat. Smoke rose from its surface in wispy streams. Even in the dark, through the heat and the smoke, the object they had made was instantly recognizable.
An anvil?
Philip cried.
That's the amazing weapon we've been making? An anvil? What are we going to do with that? Drop it on someone? Are we meant to go fight a giant roadrunner?
Jimmy muttered,
They're more effective against coyotes.
Quiet, you,
Philip said, scowling. Inchgauer laughed.
Gentlemen, you misunderstand. This is not the weapon.
Tyler thought,
For once, the dialogue tracks pretty well. Then again, Todd didn't have to be a genius to figure out what we'd be saying at this point.
Inchgauer continued.
Diluine is far too heavy to make an effective weapon, but it is the only metal hard enough to be used in the forming of Lagavulin steel, which makes excellent weapons, and of which I have an ample supply and have had all along.
The wizards groaned.
Sleep well, friends. For tomorrow we start work on the weapon. It will take a great deal of work. Luckily, I have you here to man the hammers.
The sound of the wizard's continued groaning was drowned out by laughter. Todd's chat window appeared, floating in the air behind Inchgauer.
I thought you'd like that,
Todd said, grinning sickeningly.
Oh, and thanks for the pea steam idea. Luckily, I still have time to incorporate it into the next part.